Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, April 20th, 2026. Thanks for joining us here on CJSF Radio. My name is Magnus Tevels. I'm your host for this hour. And we're going to be talking a lot about the 10th anniversary of the toxic drug crisis here in BC on April 14th, 2016. April 14th, 2016, the province of British Columbia declared a public health emergency around the toxic drug crisis. Every day people were dying throughout the province, and the numbers had gotten to the point where it could neither be ignored nor was it could be considered normal. In this century, the nature of the drug crisis has changed a lot, in the sense that the substances involved have changed a lot, with the introduction of extremely potent substances like fentanyl and carfentanil, and others that seem to be coming along all the time. The potential for a given dose that a drug user might be dealing with to be way more powerful than what they were used to. Back in the day when, with a range of substances, heroin and similar, you could count on a certain stability with what you're dealing with. Substances like fentanyl and carfentanil, even tiny amounts can be enough to cause an overdose. So, the implications of some mismeasurement in the whole process of creating an illicit drug can have grave consequences. At the same time, these substances and others are often mixed into various drugs to increase their potency, and often users won't really know what they're dealing with, and that has caused an enormous problem both here in and BC, but across North America and across the Western world. Another factor has been the increase in use of opioids in pain management for many people who might previously have not been that much at risk of becoming addicted to opioids. The introduction of drugs like oxycontin and others, and their introduction as an effective but perhaps overprescribed pain management tool, has led to many people, again, who might previously not have been at risk of substance addiction like this, to fall into the trap. Since 2016, since the drug crisis was declared, April 14th, 2016, 10 years ago this month, over 18,000 people have died from drug overdoses in British Columbia. Some numbers, and of course, it's not just about people dying from overdoses. It's also many people overdose and then recover. Either they're brought back with Narcan or other methods, or they survive. But often those overdoses, particularly if they're cumulative, if you have a number of them, can cause great damage to individuals, so that they can end up with lifelong mental disabilities, mental impairments, because of all these overdoses. The BC Emergency Medical Services, who run ambulances and coordinate ambulances around the province, have kept figures as well. You know, with from the period of 2016 to 2025 in Vancouver, almost 10,000 drug incidents that they had to respond to. You know, Burnaby 765, New West 880, Maple Ridge 847, Abbotsford just out of our region 1,661. It is a crisis that is not going away. There are a little bit of good news this year, and there seems to be a bit of a small decline since the beginning of this year in some of the numbers, and I'm not sure it's totally understood what that might be about. We can certainly speculate about things, but I haven't seen hard information, so I'm not going to get into that. Lots of things have been tried, and lots of things have been, lots of effort has been put into this issue, and yet it, for the most part, it isn't getting better. We have no idea whether this little decline we're seeing now is just a blip, or perhaps a more hopeful trend. But around the province, communities have been marking this 10-year anniversary, and we're going to visit a couple of those. We're going to start off with a report from our reporter, Danny Nesvadarani, about a ceremony last week at Lafarge Lake marking the toxic drug crisis. Then we're going to go up to Northern BC, which continues to be hit hard by the drug crisis, and a report from Pamela Hasen. And finally, to Nanaimo, another community hit hard by the drug crisis, and a report from our friends at CHLY there. So we're starting off now. This is a report from Danny Nesvadarani.
On April 14th, purple flags could be seen planted along the entire perimeter of Lafarge Lake in Coquitlam, BC. Planted by the Tri-Cities Community Action Team, each flag represents lives lost to the toxic drug crisis in BC. April 14th was also the 10th anniversary of the province of British Columbia declaring a public health emergency due to toxic drug deaths. Since then, over 18,000 people have died due to toxic drug poisoning. As part of the Tri-Cities Community Action Team's memorial, they'd set up a table at Lafarge Lake as well with resources and members of the Community Action Team available for discussion and support. CJSF went down to Lafarge Lake, where we spoke with Ian Knight, a peer with the Tri-Cities Community Action Team, and Roxanne Saxon, the organization's program coordinator, about the significance of this memorial for them. First, take a listen to Ian Knight.
I grew up in New Westminster, Burnaby area. I've recently joined the TC Action, Tri-Cities Action Team, and I'm very proud to be here today to try to make a difference in the crisis that we are in right now with the drugs and the toxicity of the drugs. Yeah, I have my own experience and stuff, like experiences with trauma and addiction as well. So it's that's the biggest reason why I'm here, is because of having that experience myself and being unhoused for many years. I want to say at the very least 15 years of my life I was on the streets and addicted to substances. And so, yeah, I'm just happy to be here today, and like it's a strong reminder of like why I want to be where I am today and not where I was. I'm grateful to be here, and I'm just going to continue trying to make a difference, you know.
Next, we asked Roxanne Saxon what some of the support resources were for those who attended the memorial.
So we have the Tri-Cities Community Action Team, so that's we have a bunch of resources for different community partners. So we're kind of here to bridge those gaps for those who are not with us. but also on site we have Naloxone, who does youth-to-youth education within schools, within the SD43, but now they're expanding. We have Fraser Health Overdose Outreach Team, who works a lot one-on-one with clients and trying to navigate where they are with their substance use on a spectrum. I'm just kind of meeting them where they're at and helping them work through their goals. We have Progressive Housing, who's right now doing outreach within the community, but they're also doing the winter shelter up until the end of the month. So they're here to serve the unhoused community and help them get housed. And we actually have a rock star with us who's seven or eight people within the community. He's able to find housing for them. And then we have Cher, who does substance use counseling and beyond, so for youth and adults. And recently they just opened up the Foundry, so that's for youth. Wraparound services for youth for 12 to 24 ages. So that's who is with us today. Oh, we also had Aster earlier, and they're no longer there. We traded places with Cher, but they were here earlier, and they do one-on-one counseling with youth specifically, and a lot of like outreach, so meeting them where they're at instead of them coming to them.
Later in our conversation, we asked them of their thoughts on the BC government's decision to end the three-year pilot project to decriminalize the possession of illicit drugs. Here is what they had to say.
Well, I think that whole project, that whole pilot, was very confusing. So they implicated it, but it wasn't very clear on what that really meant. And then all of a sudden, like, different communities were panicking. It's like, oh my gosh, it's going to be around our children at the parks. When that's not, like, people have morals at the end of the day. Like, that they're not, that's not where people are using substances. So that there's, like, all this panic around it. And then so there's just a lot of misinformation and unclear, and people weren't really sure. Like, but the problem is, like, the government's like, oh, it didn't work. Okay, well, it didn't work because you didn't have the other services in place, you didn't have the other funding for the treatment or holistic healing or wraparound services. I'm a huge advocate for wraparound services. So like, people just need to go to one place. That's all you need. You shouldn't have to go to five different places or make 20 different phone calls just to kind of get help. So that's like, I don't know, if I had to make 20 different phone calls, I'm like, no, thank you. So it's frustrating for people. So just have one place to go. And I mean, then you would see decriminalization work if you had the other resources in place.
I can't agree with you more. Wraparound services are a big part of it. I mean, because I know for me, if I had to call when I was entrenched in my addiction, I wouldn't have it. It's just too much to be taking on. I couldn't even make appointments, let alone making phone calls, you know what I mean? Especially multiple phone calls. So yeah, like Roxanne said, it's like, you know, wraparound services in one place would be ideal, just to make it a lot easier to bridge those gaps for people.
Yeah. Lastly, we asked them of the response they'd been receiving from community members throughout the day.
For sure, if it hasn't touched you, people are surprised. But I think, like, the messaging has actually been really well received. Like, even, I don't know, people aren't offended by the messaging, which is great. Like, we don't really have anybody kind of protesting against some of the messages, which is nice. So it's like that compassion in the community is there that you can feel. But there's always people, like, they have no idea what naloxone is still. So it's good. Like, even, like, it's a rainy day, so we're not getting a lot of people, and that's okay. But we've had a couple of meaningful conversations that make it all worth it.
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Check in on your loved ones. Yeah, make sure they're okay.
Absolutely.
The north of BC has been particularly hard hit by the drug crisis. And this report from Pamela Hasen at CICK in Smithers digs into that with an interview with Dr. Raquel Kling.
Nearly 10 years after the BC toxic drug crisis public health emergency was first declared, the toxic drug crisis remains one of the most devastating public health issues in the province. Since 2016, more than 16,000 people in BC have died from unregulated drug toxicity, making it the leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 59, surpassing deaths from accidents, suicides, and homicides combined. While the crisis affects every part of the province, the impact in the north is especially severe. Northern Health continues to record some of the highest death rates in BC, according to coroner's reports, with recent figures showing rates as high as 44 deaths per 10,000 people, which is well above many other regions. Fentanyl and other increasingly toxic substances dominate the unregulated supply. And today, most deaths happen indoors, often when people are using alone, making timely intervention difficult. For northern communities, the crisis is further complicated by geography, access to services, and ongoing inequities, particularly for Indigenous people who continue to be disproportionately impacted. To talk more about what the past decade has looked like in northern BC, as well as what comes next, I spoke with Northern Health's Chief Medical Health Officer, Dr. Raquel Kling. We're talking about 10 years of the toxic drug crisis in the province. And looking back over the past decade, what would you say that you see as the biggest shifts in the toxic drug crisis, particularly in northern BC communities compared to urban centers?
Well, I think a real shift that I've seen, regardless of where people live, is just how toxic the drug supply is. And we've seen shifts in what's contaminated in the drug supply, and things are getting more and more dangerous to people who use substances. And I think that's important to recognize and still be aware that, you know, even though we're 10 years in, that the drug supply is still incredibly toxic and causing a lot of people to die from using substances.
You kind of mentioned what I was talking about, which is that the drug supply becoming increasingly toxic, unpredictable. How has that reality changed the way that public health responds in smaller, more remote communities?
It just means we need to be aware of what's being contaminated in the drug supply, and knowing how we can best support our communities to respond to overdoses. So we know that with the types of contamination, such as benzodiazepines and their analogs, we know that it's getting increasingly difficult to reverse overdoses, that usual doses of naloxone that we used early on in the crisis aren't working anymore. We need to use more and more naloxone, making sure to use oxygen and other types of life-saving supplies that we can use. So yeah, we just need to be aware of what's happening in the toxic drug supply so we know how we can support our teams to save lives on the ground.
Are there other blind spots that you see in response to these last 10 years, or places where you feel like public health is falling short, you know, due to many reasons, demand, staffing, obviously you mentioned, you know, the increased toxicity of these drugs, changing nature.
Yeah, I think something, you know, especially in rural communities, you know, just making sure that we have services available for everyone that needs them, like harm reduction supplies in places where people who use substances can access them. We, like, with such a large geography, we know that it's challenging to ensure that everyone can access supplies, and we continue to work on that and expand our services and making sure we're working with communities and understanding how we can best provide care and overdose services and harm reduction services for them.
Northern and Indigenous communities have been disproportionately impacted by this crisis, and so what does a culturally appropriate and regionally effective response actually look like on the ground here in the North from your perspective?
It means, you know, working with our Indigenous partners like First Nations Health Authority and our Indigenous health team at Northern Health to ensure that we are providing culturally safe and appropriate services. And we, you know, continue to work very closely with these teams to ensure that services are appropriate.
So Dr. Kling, after 10 years of a public health emergency, do you think that BC is still treating this as an emergency, or do you feel like it's almost become normalized? And if so, what needs to change in the next decade to truly turn that tide?
I think people are still recognizing this is an emergency, but I think doing things like this and recognizing the 10-year anniversary of the drug crisis and drug emergency, I think it's really important just to keep people aware that, you know, for example, our rates in Northern Health, while they might be decreasing, they're still the highest rates of deaths in all of the province. And just keeping facts and statistics like that top of mind, I think, is important in keeping people aware and engaged in what's going on with the drug crisis. You know, focusing on preventing deaths in the moment, improving access to care, and changing systems and conditions that increase the risk, like stigma and barriers to care. You know, those are important next steps that we're focusing on in Northern Health to address this crisis.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
No problem. Thanks so much.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
We will be back with one more report about this sad anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of the declaration of a public health emergency around the toxic drug crisis. That anniversary was on April 14th, 2026, and communities around the province have been marking the date, and we're going to be heading over to Nanaimo in just a couple of minutes. But before we do that, Peter R.H. is here, and what are you going to be talking about in your segment towards the end of the show?
Well, we're going to follow up on what happened last week. And Stephen Fan, who's not here, he kind of went, oh, I heard about this CIA conspiracy about abstract expressionism. I'm going to give a more qualified what happened with the situation. And it can maybe to capitalize with more that the Museum of Modern Art that was created by the Rockefeller family is really what instigated abstract expressionism with the help at times of the CIA. But everybody who was like the main pushers of it were not so much the artists but the art critics. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that every art critic was what they call a useful idiot, or as such.
And part of what we were talking about last week was how abstract expressionism had been promoted by the CIA, and to some extent, surrealism had been promoted by.
No, what surrealism was basically promoting itself. It fizzled out for a number of reasons.
But it was very much a movement of the left rather than...
It was one movement of the left.
Yeah.
Stalin preferred... There was another movement that's called constructionism. And this was the teens.
Yeah.
And it is a modernist movement, kind of like Cubism or whatever. And they wanted the Soviet Union, the people that were involved with this movement, to... embrace that, and Stalin went for more draw a lot of pictures of myself looking great. and one last thing is that the actual futurists who loved war and everything over in Italy, they wanted Mussolini's fascist government to embrace their artistic movement, and he said no, I don't think so. So it kind of, he went to the same model. Draw a picture of me everywhere.
So we're going to be back with some art talk at the end of the program around 10:50, something like that.
Yeah.
So make sure you stick around for that. Of course, Democracy Now! Is coming up at 11 o'clock. And in about 10 minutes, we're going to have a regular weekly segment of Gardening with Embark, and we're going to be talking about container gardening. But first, we're off to Nanaimo, which is another community marking the 10th anniversary of the public health emergency with the toxic drug crisis here in British Columbia. Over 18,000 people have died since the declaration of the public health emergency. And in all those time and all the work, we have not made a lot of progress, and it is a crisis that's very much still with us here. This is a report from Lauren McKenzie in Nanaimo.
This is a CHY News update. On April 14th, 2016, the government of British Columbia declared a public health emergency in response to the increase in toxic drug deaths happening across the province. Between 2016 and the end of January 2026, 616 people have died due to unregulated deaths in Nanaimo. To reflect on this day and give space to those who have lost loved ones to the crisis, the Vancouver Island University Harm Reduction Alliance held a grief fire at the Nanaimo campus on Tuesday, April 14th. This was the second year the grief fire was held at VIU. Participants were encouraged to write messages to lost loved ones and release them to the fire.
I know deeply, and I'm sure most people around this space do, loving someone who uses substances, loving someone who uses drugs, loving someone who has lost their life to toxic drugs is an extraordinarily lonely experience simply because of the stigma of substance use.
That was Sarah Lovegrove, a nursing professor at VIU and co-founder of the VIU Harm Reduction Alliance. She told the crowd on the very rainy day that the Grief Fire is a space for people to come together and support each other.
That we really need to shoulder each other up and bring each other together in order to survive this crisis and become a community and recognize that many people in our community need support and need love.
CHY spoke to Lovegrove as people gathered around the fire. She says as the toxic drug crisis hits its 10th anniversary, this year feels a lot heavier than previous years.
I think both just being the 10th anniversary and simply like all of the backwards movement that we're seeing in the harm reduction world, it's quite devastating and heartbreaking to see all the hard work that advocates have been doing for the past 10 plus years just get rolled back because of politics, because of misinformation, and because of kind of public opinion.
Lovegrove says they started hosting the Grief Fire on campus to expand people's understanding of harm reduction and what it entails.
We've been advocating to improve established harm reduction interventions and opportunities on campus, and we really want people to know that harm reduction is a valid option and that people have the right to access harm reduction for their own substance use, for their families, for their friends, to keep them alive and keep them safe.
As someone who's been in harm reduction advocacy for 8 years, she feels devastated with how the work of ending the toxic drug crisis has gone backwards.
In that time, the toxic drug crisis has only gotten worse because the implementation of the interventions that has happened have been partial, have been not well established, not well thought out, not what people who use drugs have been asking for, and haven't worked in the way that they're supposed to work. So decriminalization was not done properly, it was not done fully, and it was done in a way that was set up for failure. Safe supply, prescribed alternatives were not offered in the proper way, and because of public opinion and public outcry, we saw a complete reversal of those interventions.
She says healthcare providers, advocates, and people who use drugs have been calling for a movement in the direction of creating a regulated supply of drugs and establishing legalization of substances, something she says we're moving further away from.
As a result of that, the drug supply is only getting more toxic. So we're seeing more people die. We're seeing more people being injured. We're seeing more complex overdoses causing trauma in responders, whether that's police, fire, peers, nurses, ambulance, everyone. Not a single person in our community has been saved of impact as a result of this. So what we're seeing is like a ripple effect of trauma and grief permeating our community.
Lovegrove says she's unsure what to do now, as she feels like politicians are not listening while the crisis becomes more and more urgent.
Chronic urgency and the constant having to respond to political games and failures. And frankly, like, I'm a human being with a broken heart, and I don't know how to fight through that anymore. I think I fought for as long as I could, and now I need to like take a moment to like recalibrate and figure out how to move forward. And I think a lot of people are there. Most people that I have been advocating and being activists when I first started in 2018, they've either quit because of burnout, relapsed in their substance use, or died as a result of toxic drugs and or suicide. And so we're losing generations of advocates and activists.
But as a nursing professor, she still has hope in the next generation of healthcare workers.
I think there is an entirely new generation of people who have been impacted by this, lost parents, lost friends, an entire generation of young people who grew up at a time with it, who never knew a drug supply that wasn't toxic. And so I think it is bolstering that next generation of people fighting for what's right. And I hope that, you know, as those people come to an age of voting and creating change, that we can turn the tides a little bit. But I'm going to keep digging into that hope as much as I can.
Michaela Brown is a psychology student and Hillary Nestor is a social work student at VIU, who joined the VIU Harm Reduction Alliance to educate fellow students on the toxic